You are listening to the Indefensive Plants podcast, a show designed to cure plant blindness around the globe. Support for Indefensive Plants comes from listener donations. If you would like to give your support to Indefensive Plants, please consider becoming a patron over at patreon.com/indefensiveplants. And together, we can help cure plant blindness one episode at a time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indefensive Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefensiveplants.com. What's up? This is your host, Matt. Welcome to the show. How is everyone doing this week? Today, we are heading to the Florida State University's Herbarium to talk to their curator, Caitlin Pearson. People like Caitlin are breathing new life into museum collections, specifically that of herbaria. Herbaria are more than just pressed plant specimens. They are windows into diversity, evolution, ecology, distributions, and so much more. And I'm very excited for what the future holds. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Caitlin. I hope you enjoy. All right, Caitlin Pearson, thanks for coming on the podcast. How about you tell us a bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, I'd love to. I am the current graduate curator of the Florida State University Robert K. Godfrey Herbarium. It's an herbarium of about 225,000 plant specimens. And I've been the graduate curator for a little over 2 years now, give or take a teaching assistantship.
Right on. And that's a pretty unique position to be in. I don't know too many schools with functioning herbaria, let alone ones that allow a graduate student to operate in a curatorial sense. Did you find this accidentally? Did you like plants coming into this? How did you end up in your role in an herbarium?
That's actually the reason I came to Florida State University. So I was from Oregon, and I saw this opportunity come up. I really wanted to work in an herbarium more consistently, not just kind of incidentally as a result of research. It's a research assistantship. And just like as if a graduate advisor would have some specific research, this is kind of the funding that they get, or that Austin Mast gets to help upkeep the herbarium. So that's where I get my paycheck, and I take care of the herbarium in return. So it's a really great gig for me because I get all this really great work experience at the same time that I'm getting research experience doing my own research here at FSU.
Awesome. And there's a lot to talk about here, but how does working in an herbarium help your research? And I guess what is it in the big picture that's going on that this position really lends well? Because when people think botany, there's this split between, oh, do I go outside and collect the plants, or am I the person inside pressing and describing and understanding the morphology? Where does this all kind of combine into what you do as a scientist?
Yeah, so my research is heavily collections based. I do kind of both the collecting my own data and using the data that's already been collected. So my research was looking at digitized images of specimens. So these are specimens that have been imaged and all their data has been collected so you can access it digitally. And I used all of those data to build models to model phenology. So that's like the timing of flowering and fruiting events. So I was using data that already exists, but in order to get a better idea of how the timing of the plants shifts or how it differs among individuals, I also went out into the field and had to collect some specimens out there as well as do some phenological monitoring. So I got to see the interplay of when you go out to the field and you get make some collections, and then as well as using what the millions of specimens that are already.
That's impressive. And it's really interesting to think about how, sure, we talk about phenology and climate change in a geographic location. You read Walden, you say, oh, these plants are now blooming earlier than they ever have before. But what this sounds like it allows you is a much larger spectrum of individuals and time periods to choose from that you wouldn't have by just accessing data for even one site, let alone many different sites. Is that where kind of this interface with herbarium work really kind of fits in with what's going on?
Yeah, so that's just one example. We looked at genetics in populations and on a larger scale when you're building phylogenies. So that was realized when we understood what DNA was, and that wasn't that long ago. So just imagine what these hold for the potential in the future.
Yeah, and the sheer volume of what's out there. You're at one herbarium, but there are herbaria across the globe with different levels and sizes of collection and different species. So just the sheer mass of data tucked away often in forgotten corners, or at worst, being destroyed because no one realizes the current value of what all of that means.
Definitely. I think that's a huge shame when those get left unattended, because they really do require curation. Just like if you had a whole bunch of old books or a whole bunch of knickknacks that you collected, they all need attention in some way. And these ones are especially hard to care for because they're bug food. So, but yeah, there are herbaria across the entire globe in large institutions, small institutions. The institution that I went to for my undergraduate only had probably 100, maybe 200 specimens in a single cabinet. And here I am with just shy of 250,000 specimens. And then there are herbaria in, for example, Paris and London that have millions of specimens in them too. So it's really amazing.
Wow. Some perspective for the average listener that doesn't think about these sorts of deals. But in the context of your work, you mentioned phenology, which can mean a lot of different things. What kind of questions were you seeking to ask, and what did you end up find? I mean, you mentioned you finished up, and that's a big place to be. So what was kind of the consensus of your attempts?
So I was looking at the phenology of about 87 species of plants in the sunflower family, or Asteraceae. Wow. I was looking at how they respond to changes in temperature and precipitation. So I was specifically looking in the southeastern United States, because that region has been very little studied in regards to phenology. So there was an idea that, well, things are changing up in temperate zones where they have really drastic climates. But here in Tallahassee, where it never gets colder than 30 degrees, I mean, is there really that much, you know, change in phenology? Are these plants really responding to the changing climate if the changing climate is really not that big? Well, it turns out they are. And we actually have two flowering peaks here in the southeastern United States. There's one in the spring, like you normally think of, but there's also really a huge bloom in the fall. And what my models told me is that the spring plants, just like in temperate zones, they're responding by flowering earlier with warming. However, the fall flowering plants were responding by flowering later. So maybe they're trying to avoid the really hot summer temperatures. Who knows? But this could have pretty big implications for pollinators or herbivores who need those resources in the spring and in the fall. So these are being farther apart, and that could be a little bit dangerous for whoever is relying on those to be there.
Wow. That is a lot to think about in the context of an ecosystem scale, and that's with just 80 species and one family. Imagine now that multiplied throughout the ecosystem, and it's just a stark reminder that plants aren't operating in a vacuum. A mistimed flowering event for a plant, okay, that's one reproductive year. But like you said, pollinator resources, especially in ecosystems that have distinct seasons for those sorts of things, that is cause for alarm and cause for more questions and more research needed.
Definitely. And like you said, this was only in one family, and this family isn't a huge resource for seed feeding animals as much as some other species. But there is some indication that in certain regions where migratory birds rely on berries being available, for example, when they're coming up from South America or going down to South America, if there's a mistiming in the fruiting events there, there could be lowered fitness, and maybe some birds can't even breed because they weren't able to get enough food. So this has potential trophic effects even higher than just plants and insects.
Yeah, that's, again, cause for some alarm. And again, the value of this is that you have access to enough specimens, enough individuals to get that kind of resolution out of the data. Because otherwise, you know, one aberrant year, two aberrant years, oh, okay, maybe that's just something one-off. And so I guess when people think about someone sitting in front of an herbarium specimen, it's a pressed plant, it's squished, right? A lot of the color, it's dried. What is data collection like for you? How do you get one specimen from to the next and understand flowering time and things that almost feel like you kind of have to be in nature to observe them? Where does that connection happen with herbarium specimens? I don't know if I asked that properly.
Well, so each specimen you can think of as like a very rich ball of data, or okay. like a little time capsule. So each specimen has a date, a location, it has the physical appearance of the specimen, it has the collector, and hopefully it has some other details about that collection event and that specimen. And the date and the location, those are easy to access because they're usually text format. We're used to putting those as data points, but then the physical specimen is kind of a lot harder to parse. And for in my research, I had to stare at one of, or all of these 15,000 herbarium specimen images and decide whether they were flowering or not and approximately in which stage of flowering they were. So it requires a lot of human effort, but that's how we do. That's how you collect data.
Indeed, yeah, and that is what I think a lot of students sorely need to recognize earlier on before they start jumping in. Because it could sound great in theory, but my hat is totally off to your ability to scrutinize and have that kind of attention to detail. I personally don't think I have it in me. That is really impressive efforts that need to be put in to do these sorts of things.
My thanks to the iDigBio crew for helping me download thousands of images so that I could actually look at them. So
yeah.
These images were available because of large-scale digitization projects, which are actually in the United States have been funded by the NSF. To get all of these specimens, which are generally, you know, flat sheets and a whole bunch of cabinets, get pictures of them or even just data. So taking down the data that is on the specimen labels. And that's really transformative because these collections were being made before there were even computers. But we don't even necessarily have ledgers of what specimens we have. We have probably hundreds of specimens that we don't even know exist in here because we haven't been able to put a barcode on them and write down what they are. Just too many specimens. So we and many, many institutions across the world have been working on digitizing these data, making them available for researchers like me. So I would not have been able to download 15,000, 20,000 specimen images if it wasn't for these concerted efforts across the entire world to get that data out there. So I was using specimens from the Smithsonian, from New York Botanic Garden, from University of Florida, from hundreds probably of institutions, thanks to digitization.
Wow. That is some remarkable perspective. Thank you so much for bringing that up, because I never thought about the effort it would take to have even all of those shipped to you, let alone the logistical nightmare of keeping track of what went where. Is it being shipped properly? Is it being housed properly? That is so good to hear, the need for a lot of effort on multiple people and institutions, but I can imagine tons of volunteers as well.
For sure. This has been a huge effort by a lot of staff with the institutions and with iDigBio, at least in the United States. And then, of course, tons of workers. We have student workers. We have volunteers. We have staff members like me who are, in addition to other curatorial things, we do digitization. We also have some citizen science efforts that are done to help digitization. So, for example, Notes from Nature, which is through the Zooniverse citizen science platform, they put on images of specimens, and citizen scientists can go on and look at those specimens and then type in what they see, kind of explore the specimens. There are all these little expeditions that you can help finish depending on where you are or what type of plants you're interested in.
Wow.
So that's been really neat. Sometimes in my free time, I go and do that too, but
a noble pursuit, if you will. That's incredible, actually. I had no idea that this, and I'm sure many others like me have no idea this is available. And if anyone's looking to get their feet wet in a little bit of true at the core botany, that's an awesome opportunity. Just again, what is this like? Do I like doing this even?
Yeah, it's really fun because it's something that you can do that directly contributes to science from the comfort of your own couch. It's really neat. We also have, in October, there is the We Dig Bio event, which is a worldwide engagement for digitizing biodiversity specimens. And that's a big push where we get a whole bunch of museums together and a bunch of collections. And it's not only for plants. This is for insects and fossils and all sorts of things. And we all get together and try to engage volunteers in doing these types of transcription efforts. So look for that coming up in October.
Awesome. I'm so excited for this podcast to be going out in the summer here so that people can actually prepare for those sorts of deals.
Yeah.
I know plenty of people that would love to just, you know, dabble a little bit.
Definitely. Yeah, this is a good place to start.
And another way, just benefit from this is the fact that how many times does the public really truly get to go behind the scenes like that and see what real museum curation is like? This is a rare opportunity to go behind closed doors, literally, mm-hmm. and see the specimens that have changing science as we know it.
Definitely.
Awesome. Okay, so you're at the herbarium. You have way more on your plate than just your graduate work. Congrats.
Yeah, thank you.
So along with this is all of those other specimens that you're not looking at. And, you know, 250,000 is a lot of specimens. So as the flip side of the coin, your curatorial position, what is it day-to-day like in an herbarium? What are your duties? What things do you have to always keep in mind? You mentioned bugs getting in and munching. It's bug food still, stride.
Mm-hmm.
What is your job like?
What is my job? So my day-to-day, I have a lot of things that depend on whether we have correspondence asking for us to ship specimens to people. So people still ask for loans of specimens, and we are constantly exchanging and making gifts and receiving gifts of specimens. The collections community is very interactive in that we really like to spread the specimens around. It's an old practice that whenever you collect a plant and you can ethically collect a duplicate of that, then you collect a duplicate and then you send that to some other institution. And in that way, if your institution burns down or is flooded or gets hit by a hurricane, which is more likely here in Florida, some other institution has a copy of that specimen. It's also useful for if you have someone who is an expert and they live at a different institution, you can send them yours and they say, hey, actually, I've discovered that it's this. Then you can come and annotate your own specimen without having to ship things back and forth multiple times. Huh. So duplicates. Wow. Yeah, working with duplicates and working with loans. So we have lots of people who want to do DNA work, or they want to look at the morphology to try to figure out, oh, is this species or is it this species? Or maybe we can split this species in half because they occur in two places. Who knows? So still a lot of work being done there. Like you mentioned, there's still a lot of pest control. So we do integrated pest management, which is constantly checking the cabinets for book lung. Luckily, we don't have beetles, which are a very big problem in the herbarium community in general, but we have these little tiny lice that just munch up the plants in a couple months, and so we have to throw those all in the freezer for several weeks to a month and then re-put them all back into the cabinet. So
Wow. Definitely
a lot of work there.
At least you're not nuking the place with some sort of chemical like they probably were doing way back when.
Yeah, back in history, there were all sorts of creative ways that people tried to get rid of pests and insects. So they used to use mercuric chloride, which obviously you don't want to use anymore. You know, mothballs were used for a long time. There was some sort of powder that used to be used. So I'm glad to be living in the age of just using a freezer.
Who'd have thought the most archaic form of killing life could have been the best? Oh, that's fascinating, though. And I'm really intrigued by this idea of duplicate. I hadn't thought of that. And again, it's like backing up your data. You have a ton of data that desperately needs to be backed up, provided, again, ethics can allow for extra specimen collecting. But it's conservation in another standpoint. You know, living conservation, you have ex situ individuals to avoid, like you said, floods, hurricanes, fires, disease, insect outbreaks. I never thought about that with dried specimen, but it makes complete sense, especially for things like holotypes. You know, God forbid you lose the one thing that was the entire description of that species.
Definitely.
So you have quite enough on your plate to keep you busy, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's in addition to all the digitization that I do. We're constantly bringing in new specimens, so I always have to database those and image those. And recently we acquired an herbarium that was shut down. So it was a smaller institution and they couldn't keep the funding for it. So we decided that we had just enough room in our cabinets. And so we took on that institution's herbarium. So we've been filing those all into our system kind of slowly because we wanted to make sure to vet them beforehand and make some updating to the taxonomy, things like that. So we're actually just finishing accessioning that entire collection Wow. into our collection. So that's a big feather in my cap. I got to be part of that.
Well done. That's cool to see it through to some sort of logical conclusion that you could say, we've walked away from this.
Yeah, worked with a lot of interns and a lot of volunteers to make it happen. So thanks to undergrads.
Yes. Yes, research is often built on the back of grads and undergrads. So digitization, really interesting that this is where it's going, the old scanner technique, but I'm assuming you need a certain level of detail that's preserved in the scan in order for it to be an effective specimen. Is this something you kind of need a proper institution or at least the funding to get a hold of said equipment, or are there resources out there that people can just go to and say, can we just scan these, please?
Yeah, you don't necessarily need a whole lot of fancy equipment. So we have a mounted camera and then kind of a standardized frame that we put all of our specimens in so that it has a little ruler on it and some color palettes and things like that. It really is not terribly technologically advanced. We're just using a good camera.
Okay.
So it's really accessible for a lot of smaller institutions as well. It might be hard to budget in, you know, $1,000 camera. But FSU, for example, has helped several other smaller institutions like University of West Florida, the Selby collection. So these are collections that we helped with some funding from a grant to digitize their herbaria because they were so much smaller and more approachable. So there are larger institutions are helping. IDigBio is definitely helping. And there are a lot of digitization resources on IDigBio.org as well. So for smaller institutions who are looking into doing that, that's a really good place to start.
Excellent. That's really nice that it's, again, this collaborative effort. There's no stepping on toes or egos getting in the way. It truly is best served when everyone kind of gets together and says, hey, I've got things, you've got things, we can all work on this, and volunteers can join, and it just brings, it's like a community.
That's one of the things that has really almost surprised, but really just like amazed and made me really excited, is the fact that this community is so collaborative. And so forward thinking. So they're always thinking about, all right, this is how we're digitizing these things now, but how can we do this better? How can we be more efficient? How can we reach more people? How can we make these data more available for a longer time? And they're really working with each other to make this happen. So whenever I had a problem with research, I would ask someone in IDigBio or someone at another institution that I had met through IDigBio and just say, hey, how have you approached this project? And they were just super willing to brainstorm with me and give me advice.
Oh, that's excellent. So you're also in this unique position at an herbarium because plant collections, living or preserved, give you such an integrated look at diversity, form and function, the changes, the minute differences between closely related individuals, and the broad differences between distantly related individuals. And that is all so well served when it's right in front of you instead of reading a list of species names or something like that. How does your work in working in the herbarium and being in this curatorial position really help inform your viewpoint on biodiversity and biogeography? Because that's really important for a lot of people, but to truly understand and put something solid, an idea behind what biodiversity means for, say, conservation is a little bit more nebulous.
Well, so I would say for me personally, working in an institution, it's really awesome to just go into the stacks and pull out a folder for every species that is in our collection, pull them all open and be able to see how remarkably similar they are, even though this one was collected in California and this one was collected in Utah and this was in New York. They may be different species, but within a genus, they're so similar. Mm. So that's been really cool to just, you kind of see evolution in fast forward when you're here, because you say, oh, I see the end point of evolution all laid out in front of me. So that's really nice to really neat and interesting to see. One of the reasons that got me into studying plant diversity is, wow, they're so different, but they're so the same in different ways.
Right. And millions of years on us at that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really cool perspective, and I like that you put it, it's like the endpoints. You are seeing the endpoints of these radiations as it is now in this human time frame snapshot. but the perspective on how evolution works and just being able to couch that in the context of location maybe, or an odd variant that was isolated from the others, it just really starts to paint a more cohesive picture of life on this planet, right? I mean, do you feel more in tune to the threats to biodiversity as a result by just understanding, okay, this is only here, but this one's over here and a little bit more, but if we lose this population, that sort of deal?
Yeah, so we have several, especially here in the Florida Panhandle, we have several species that are endemic to a very small region in the Panhandle. So being able to look at all of these specimens that have been collected in this teeny little folder that has six specimens of this endemic species going, wow, that is really rare. And then looking at the distribution maps and going, wow, it only occurs in this place. That's really amazing. And I think one of the things that has amazed me as well is realizing that it's because of their evolutionary lineage, perhaps, that they have become endemic there. Because with the changes in the Earth for over, you know, thousands, millions of years, species have moved around. They have gotten to one place and left another, gotten cut off from the rest of the individuals and evolved, kind of been a little circular pattern in their own area. So that's just something that I've learned from living in Florida because we have so many of these endemic species.
Yeah. And what opportunity do you have in any single day, let alone a week or month or time, to actually have all of them split out in front of you next to each other to then look at and compare and understand on a deeper level?
Mm-hmm.
And the other part, too, is we've kind of hinted at conservation. Your work on phenology can inform where we might need to work on concerns for potential reintroductions or decoupled mutualisms. But in the greater context, how does this herbarium work or research really start informing conservation on a practical level that we can, as citizens, then go out and act upon a lot quicker than otherwise?
Mm. So herbarium specimens are often the basis by which we have a distribution of a species. So the reason why we know that this plant is endemic is not just because some botanists who've been here for 50 years say, yeah, it's always been in that area. We need some actual data to tell us where it is. And so the herbarium specimens are usually where conservation, like the Florida Natural Areas Inventory or other institutions, will start to look for those plants. And then they can start finding what habitats it will live in and look whether its range is contracting or expanding. Because remember, we have these collections for over, 100 years or so. So we can see, oh, it's been in this place in the past. Let's go look for it today. Oh, no, there's a shopping mall there. So we can look at how the distributions have been changing and then make some hypotheses as to why they're changing in the way they are. And from those, hopefully be able to predict ways to make that stop happening if it's something we're doing, or happen more if they're expanding. So we've captured little pieces of genetics with these herbarium specimens. So there's the potential for seed banking through the herbarium. Not a hugely done thing, but there's that potential.
Wow. And again, as technology advances, who knows where that's going to go and what we can actually do with an old DNA or old seed specimens. But just this idea of building a range map, it seems so straightforward. You look at it and it's in most field guides or on most websites. You'll see a range map and people see, oh, my state is all green, it's native here. You zoom in, okay, there's some records in this county and that county. All of that, I'm guessing, was based on some sort of herbarium specimen and oftentimes is poorly understudied because, say, someone went out 100 years ago, made that collection, and no one has revisited it or decided to collect it since. So just, again, these points that sit along the timeline geographically, that's huge.
Mm-hmm. Herbaria are the reason we know where plants are. The reason people in the East knew what plants were in the West after Lewis and Clark came back is because of herbarium specimens that they collected while they were over there. And now we know what Lewis and Clark saw when they were over there and what Thoreau saw when he used to live in Massachusetts and all sorts of things. So we really are getting this amazing time travel through these specimens.
Yeah, I like that it's can easily be thought of as time travel in a very loose sense. But I mean, even from my own perspective, I remember trying to go out to an area I wasn't familiar with to help scout for an endemic species, and I cannot go from a species description to an actual image of the plant in my head. So even just having an herbarium specimen to go, all right, I think I know what I'm looking for now, that alone is so valuable.
Definitely. Many researchers will come in and some people from the Florida Fish and Wildlife, they came in and said, this endemic species and this native species that isn't endemic look so similar, we can't tell whether we have the endemic species in our field site. So they plopped this folder down here and this folder down here, opened them up and went, okay, I'm starting to see the differences between these species. And so then those botanists were empowered to go out into the field and say whether or not this endemic species was on their field site. So having the physical specimen there, even for the education of botanists and of people who work for the government and who work for natural area inventories and other sorts of things, these are huge resources for them.
Yeah, because how often do you hear someone say, oh, you could kind of tell a lot better when you have them, you know, side by side. How often does that actually happen in nature?
Well, this one happens only in dry places, and only in this one in wet places, yeah. So I can't even tell.
So again, just physically having specimens in front of you makes so much of a difference. And just as we can hear in your passion and your delight with working with this sort of work is just, it's invaluable, even just as inspiration, to get out there and want to know more about biodiversity and how plants look and interact and where they're growing and where they're not and what are the threats facing them. And then, again, going back to the herbivory stuff, the amount of other clues about the environment, it actually starts to kind of blow your mind how much value was in these collections and the work that you're doing with them.
For sure. Yeah, I am... super happy to be able to work with them and really make this resource available to so many scientists and researchers and even the public.
And there's a lot that can be done. I think there's almost an artistic element to herbarium collections that can really open the door to a wider swath of interest from the general public and people that want to give back in some way but don't really know how or don't think they have the technical skills for, you know, taxonomic descriptions or something like that.
Yeah, people will do botanical illustrations based off of specimens. Mm-hmm. So we have a big collection of botanical illustrations that were based off some of the specimens that were in this institution and from field photos, things like that. So they all come from somewhere, and a lot of the times it's specimens. And they can be really artistic, these specimens can. So I often will tweet a picture of a specimen that I just really love. Like you probably saw recently, I posted a picture of grass flowers because people don't think of grasses as having flowers. And here I saw these adorable little flowers and put them out there. And so they can be really inspiring once you kind of get a closer and more intimate look at plants, not necessarily in the field, but when you can look at them really close up. You can start to see these really interesting patterns and distinctive features, and they're really inspiring even just to look at.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I can't think of a more relaxing way. It's like a hard day, sit back, like, I'm just going to go look at something beautiful for a little bit and admire nature in all its glory.
Yep.
That's cool. So, okay, this chapter, a great chapter by the sounds of it, of your life is coming to a close. You're a newly minted scientist. You've got ideas rattling around in your head, a new appreciation for the work. I know this is kind of a dreaded question, but, you know, what's on the horizon? What are you excited about? What are you hoping for? I mean, anyone would be lucky to have you working for them, obviously, but what are you excited about?
Oh, thanks. Well, I'm really excited to keep on working with herbarium specimens and even just collections in general. I'm really passionate about making these resources available and keeping them in good condition. Like, these have been here for 100 years because there have been careful curators in the past. So I'm really passionate about making sure that they stay in good condition and making them available for researchers, artists, and in kind of an extra level. So because all of the stuff that I did in my research was highly computer-based, I'm also very involved in making the data accessible. So not just images of specimens, but making the data accessible and readable and standardized. That's a huge problem in this field, is that every institution is going to do something differently. So data cleaning is a huge nightmare if you start trying to work with these data. But I think that there are some really innovative and collaborative ways that we can work on doing the same things, or at least making some tools that will help us cross all of our data, integrate all of our data in better ways. So I'm really excited to keep on working on that. I recently published a paper that was about a tool that used data from herbarium specimens. So that's something I really like to think about, is how we can use the technologies that we have to make this research go quicker, be more efficient, and really broader in scope. So both of those things really interest me.
Wow. Thankfully, someone like you exists to be doing these sorts of things. Because again, how many institutions or individuals think about these sorts of big picture questions about how do we manage data on a big scale? And this is so useful if only people can easily access it and utilize it. So keep it up, please.
Thanks. There are quite a few of us who are thinking about these, so I'm just excited to be part of the bigger picture.
Awesome. Well, open call to all of them to scream at the top of their lungs about their work.
Yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Well, if people want to keep in touch, find out what you got going on, learn more about how they can get involved, and even just help out in this process, how do you recommend them finding out more about you, your work, or just reaching out to you?
Well, hearing about me, I guess they could follow me on Twitter. I'm at the Meerkat. That's T-H-E-M-E-R-E-K-A-T. Sorry, it's a little bit difficult.
It's all right, I can put up links.
All right, great. Yeah, that I'll be leaving this institution soon, but I'll still be on Twitter. That seems to be where most of the botanists are right now.
Yeah, it's been a great resource.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Well, I'll put up links to that. And thank you so much for coming on and giving us some much needed perspective on curating and herbarium work.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's been real fun.
Yeah, this has been great. I wish you the best. Good luck.
Thanks so much.
All right, cheers.
Bye.
Well, that was a fantastic discussion. I thank Caitlin for taking time out of what is a busy schedule to talk with us. You really should follow her on Twitter, get great updates from the herbarium, and whatever is on the horizon for her, I'm sure it's going to be fantastic. Once again, you can find her on Twitter at TheMeerkat, T-H-E-M-E-R-E-K-A-T. So go do that. Otherwise, thank you for listening. There's a lot of great stuff on the horizon. I know I say that all the time, but I mean it. A lot of great interviews coming up, so stay tuned. Also, if you haven't already heard, July 20th, we will be releasing our short film called Dunes. So head on over to youtube.com/indefensiveplants and click that subscribe button so you can watch it as soon as it's released. All right, everyone, this is your host, Matt, signing out. Adios.
This episode was produced in part by Clifton, Stephanie, Rochelle, Benjamin, Eli, Rachel, Anthony, Tim, Philip, Lisa, Brent, Letitia, Ron, Tim, Homestead Brooklyn, Brody, Kevin, Sophia, Brian, Mark, Renz, Bendix, Aaron A., Holly, Mountain Misery Farms, Caitlin, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, and Margie.